The death of 7 Israelis at a synagogue at the hands of a Palestinian, and in less than 24 hours, another shooting incident resulting in the injury of 2 Israelis. These incidents may have come as a shock to many, but it falls pale to the number of Palestinians that have been killed at the hands of the Israeli regime. In this edition of The Spotlight, we will look at Israel's security failure, the rise of grassroots Palestinians against the Israeli regime, and whether this new cabinet can even last what appears to be a wave of Palestinian resistance, including Israel's internal crisis with its own people. First, let me introduce our guest for this edition of The Spotlight. Frog Hughes, author and director of Palestine Aid Belfast, joins us from Belfast. Also joining us is Arnold August, author and journalist, who joins us from Montreal.
This is The Spotlight. The Spotlight takes an in-depth look at the headlines, featuring interviews with well-known guests from diverse backgrounds to get to the bottom of the story. You can listen to The Spotlight every day on IRIB English Radio.
All right, gentlemen, welcome to you. But Frau Hughes, first to you. So you have 7 Israelis that were killed. 21 years old is the age of the person, or the Palestinian who did that. And then in less than 24 hours, you have another 2 that were injured in a shooting incident. This one was carried out by a 13-year-old. I'm mentioning the age because it's significant in the follow-up questions that I'm going to ask. What's your reaction to what has occurred, first of all?
Well, I think if we put things in context, that you've seen last year in 2022, 150 Palestinians were killed, murdered, some were already executed by the Israeli illegal occupation in the West Bank. And already in January and the first month of 2023, we have had up to 40 Palestinians, some were already executed, along with many, many more injured. I think if you look back at the history of the occupation, which is illegal, if you look at the 1 million illegal Zionist Israeli Jewish settlers in the West Bank. This is in contravention of the Fourth Geneva Convention, which states that Israel, as an occupying force, illegally occupying force, should not move its civilian population into the occupied territories. Indeed, in 2002 in Jenin, you had this refugee camp filled with refugees from 1948, when Israel, the Israeli state, was born in bloodshed by terrorism, by many of the people who went on to become the leaders of Israel at that time, regarded by the British government as terrorists. In 2002, you had 52 people murdered in Jenin by the illegal Zionist occupation forces. So there is a history going back to 1948 and the Nakba. There's a history going back to 1967 and the illegal occupation of the West Bank, of the continued ethnic cleansing of Palestinians from their land and from their homes. While Israeli settlers build homes illegally on land that has been confiscated or stolen or illegally occupied by the settler movement, they have stolen water resources, they have stolen arable land, and they have occupied the homes of the indigenous population. So when we see heavily armed troops going into Jenin, a refugee camp, in order to summarily arrest and or execute people, you know, you're going to have resistance to this oppression. And Palestinians, under international law, can use any and all means of resistance against this illegal occupation. And with the new right-wing Israeli government heavily kind of indebted to the settler movement, right, and getting a lot of their votes and a lot of their political value from the settler movement, I'm not surprised that settlers have faced the brunt of Palestinian resistance.
Yeah, point well taken. I mean, if you want to take a look at this, Arnold August, what our guest there said, obviously there's a history there of the way that Palestinians have been violated in so many words. I mean, from the deaths to the detainment to all the core issues that exist. I mean, we can go through, we can't because we don't have the time, but so many ways that they have been violated. Many are not shocked at what has happened. And that is one of the most interesting points, because even Israelis, in terms of the outpouring, if you want to gauge even social media, even though they regret what has happened, but they're not really that shocked as they should be, because Israel has violated Palestinian rights so much, especially with the most recent massacre that occurred in Jenin refugee camp. So wasn't this a natural occurrence, as the Palestinian resistance groups have said, to occur? And this being based on what happened in Jenin with that massacre of the 10 Palestinians?
Yeah, thank you for having me. And both what you said and what Fred just mentioned as well, I think we're pointing to a very important scenario or analysis, and that is the resistance in Palestine is developing, has been developing for some time. And I guess this is one of the reasons that Israel tries to intimidate the Palestinian resistance, for example, what they did in Jenin. And I would like to say we're not alone in thinking that. I'm a member of the Board of Trustees of the Global Gathering in support of the Palestinian resistance. And they just issued a very powerful statement only a few hours ago in which they say that they fully support the attack against the Israelis in Jerusalem, and is part of this wave of further development of Palestinian resistance using armed struggle. It is their only way. How else can Palestinians defend themselves if it is not for armed struggle? And I think that we are heading in that direction. And it's interesting that, as you mentioned, the reaction from the ground in Israel is not as powerful against this act by the Palestinians as it normally is. But I think it's one thing is clear, that Jerusalem is occupied by United States and Israel. And according to all laws and norms internationally, an occupied people have a right to resist. And this is what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. They had a right to resist. Of course, this is being, well, the United States, of course, their spokesman, Blinken, and others from the State Department, they didn't blink an eye. Sorry for the pun. They didn't blink an eye. They called it a terrorist organization, while at the same time saying, well, we don't have all the facts, what happened in Jerusalem yesterday. We know the facts. The main fact is that Israel, as an arm of the United States, has been carrying on this terrorist activity, as Fra just mentioned, for many years. We're talking about decades, and it is bound to erupt as it has in Jerusalem today, and who knows what will happen again. In fact, there was another attack only a few hours ago, so this is building up, and the armed resistance is building up. And the support of the Islamic Republic of Iran is very important for the morale and also armaments for the Palestinian resistance. This has to come to an end. We are in a stage where no one can turn a blind eye to the massacres, or I would say genocide, ongoing genocide by the Israeli Zionist entity against the Palestinian people.
Okay. Well, I just checked before I was going to ask you this question, Fra Hughes, as to whether there was an outcome from the cabinet meeting that Netanyahu has held. So far, there's no news on that. And the reason why I'm bringing this topic up is because based on the source of an Israeli journalist and commentator who worked for Israel's Channel 13 News, he has said that the recommendations by Prime Minister Netanyahu will be for a law to deport families of terrorists, in reference to the Palestinians, immediate sealing of terrorist homes, arresting family members and friends, and then sending out reinforcements to the occupied West Bank. And then the last one, which we're going to get into later, approving more gun licenses to the civilian population of Israel. Now, that's really important, and I don't want to have you address this now, because I'm going to ask the question later. But it does not sound appropriate to the degree of violence that you would expect from this cabinet. It almost sounds like they're somewhat intimidated. The tone of what's being proposed is not that extreme, if I may use that word, unless that's an incorrect interpretation of what's being proposed. Because one would think that you would think things like, let's go to the terrorists, let's go to the Palestinian homes and get rid of Palestinians, etc. But it doesn't have that type of a tone to it. Am I reading this correctly, first of all?
I'm not sure. I think it's a very extreme reaction. I know over the years it has been Israeli policy, or has been in the past, to knock down the homes of the people who are involved in the resistance and in resistance operations, and indeed to knock down maybe the homes either side or parallel to the home of the Palestinian resistance fighter. I mean, this is actually a punitive revenge and retribution upon the community. This is collective punishment against individual acts. I heard the father of the martyr yesterday, who was involved in the operation in Al-Quds, say that he was unaware that his son was perhaps a member of any paramilitary resistance organization. He stated that, everyone has a different view on the occupation and how to resist that, or how to kind of rebel against what the occupation is doing. So, these community repercussions where you knock down the home of the family. Indeed, it's the first time I've heard of Israel threatening to deport the families. I mean, are they going to deport them to Jordan? Are they going to deport them to Gaza, which is more likely? This is a form of continued ethnic cleansing, a continuation of the Nakba. I mean, if you have an intifada, for example, in the West Bank, and you have tens of thousands of young men, teenage boys, engaged in throwing bricks and bottles at armoured vehicles that can do absolutely no damage to them. When you look at the nine people who were martyred in Jenin, the Israeli army was claiming that there was a gun battle. But no Israeli troops have been injured. So, I mean, where are the guns? Where are the weapons? Where is the video camera surveillance? Because drones were involved and missiles were involved. And I read that their initial raid, that they came in a refrigerated van, in a civilian van, surrounded a house and fired missiles at it. So this is the response of the Israeli offensive forces, is to surround, attack. And apparently there were four people found dead in that building once the Israeli forces withdrew.
What do you think, Arnold August, about these recommendations that supposedly is going to be brought up in this cabinet meeting? Again, this is not confirmed yet. But I guess there, and rightly so, says that these are pretty severe and extreme, because some of the comments that I'm reading now on social media are actually pointing towards that, saying they're ethnic cleansing, just like our guest Fraud Hughes there said. Because, for example, law for deporting families of terrorists, again, as Israel sees them, or immediate sealing of terrorist homes, or arresting family members and friends, these are all pretty severe based on the viewpoint. Do you agree with that, that the steps taken are severe? Because it also points to the extinguishing the Palestinian existence off the land, in a sense.
Yes, it is a very serious set of actions that the Israeli government is considering. But I think if they do that, it will backfire, because the Israelis know, whether they admit it or not, but the resistance, the armed resistance, for example, supported to a large extent by Iran, and the resistance on the ground has been building up for several months now. And I like to, the United States and Israel may be in for a surprise. I like to quote from my board, in which I'm a member, and they say openly that the person who carried that out in Jerusalem, Kari Al-Kam, is a young Magdisi, a resistance fighter who was breastfeeded with a Palestinian mother's milk. So here we go. While Israel is perhaps going to take some extreme action, the resistance, in my view, has never been stronger than it is now. and also the use of social media by the resistance. We often talk the social media used by United States or Israel, but the social media increasingly being used by the resistance is going to provide a further emphasis, a further impulse to the type of resistance that we're seeing, where the gathering, the group of gathering in Lebanon say openly, we have to use rifles, we have to use arms in order to overthrow the Zionist regime and head towards the liberation of Palestine. Uh-huh. So United States, they must be blustering, but there's the other side of the story as well. Increased development, the increased level of struggle based on any means necessary.
Well, this new phase, some have called it, Frahius, whether you agree or not, is my question to you, where you have these sole individuals, Palestinians, that is, who are emerging and acting on their own, even though they're carrying out pretty sophisticated operation, like what has happened in the past two incidents in the past 24 hours. Now, on the one hand, you have them so young. I mean, we're looking at 21-year-old and a 13-year-old that have carried it out. But it's somewhat smelling a new resistance, isn't it, in terms of the operation being carried out by them, because they have no affiliations with typical resistance groups like Islamic Jihad or Hamas. And one example, good example, I guess, would be a group by the name of Den of Lions that emerged in August of 2022, where they acted against the Israeli regime. Are we looking at this being a more commonplace incident of these Palestinians with no affiliations rising up on their own? And, of course, it's because they're being choked by the Israeli regime in terms of a variety of things that you're well aware of.
Well, I think one of the major dangers that you've just alluded to for the Israeli state and for the settler movement is that I'm sure there are many brave members of the resistance groups, but I'm sure there are many people who are the eyes and ears of the Israeli security forces, Shin Bet, etc., Mossad within the West Bank, who do watch the resistance groups, do watch the resistance fighters, do watch the commanders, and do inform on the resistance groups within the West Bank. So if you're going to have individuals and young people with absolutely no affiliations and be seen to be clean operatives, it'll be very difficult to stop these attacks going forward. And there's maybe two things I'd like to say. One of them is, I think it was Golda Meir who said that the old will die and the young will forget. Well, a 21-year-old Palestinian in Al-Quds did not forget, and a 13-year-old boy who apparently his brother has already been martyred by the Israeli illegal occupation. So if you're going to kill 16-year-old boys, you may well find their 13-year-old siblings coming forward demanding a pound of flesh. And it reminds me in many respects of the suicide bombings that happened in and around, I would guess, 2002 with what happened in Jenin. If you keep crushing a people, if you keep destroying their homes, stealing their futures, giving them nightmares instead of dreams of a peaceful future, people have nothing else to react with except their own lives. And if they're willing to submit their lives, to make a point and to fight the oppressive illegal regime that oppresses them and represses them, I think that that's something that you'll see more of.
Well, taking a look at Israel right now as we speak, in terms of its occupying Palestine, the land of Palestine, there are protests that are happening, Arnold, August, and I mentioned that in the beginning in my question. You have Israelis that are out there protesting. Now, take a guess as to what they are protesting. Your options would be A, are they protesting how they're against this cabinet, taking laws in their own hand, wanting to reform what they call judiciary, which is under question in terms of it even being a judiciary, or B, it's because of what happened, which is one of the worst attacks. In the past 24 hours, you have 7 Israelis that were killed, some in serious condition, with another 2 in a span of 24 hours. Which do you think they're protesting?
Well, I didn't see the footage of that, nor did I have a chance to read the report.
I'll tell you what they're protesting. They're protesting about those laws. To them, though there's 7 Israelis that were killed in less than 24 hours, that to them is not even a concern, because for them, their concern is how Netanyahu Arnold August, are you with us? Okay, good.
Yes,
their concern
I am.
Is how Netanyahu is trying to take laws into its own hands to try to decrease or trying to favor laws to its own favor, trying to reform laws to his own favor. Now, my question is, you have that on the one hand. You have Palestinians, young Palestinians with no affiliations rising up. You have the resistance groups at the same time. These are pulling this new cabinet apart in different directions. What are the chances of it surviving this?
I think, thank you for quoting that. It makes it very clear. So the people in Israel, occupied Palestine, who are demonstrating against the government, even though it may not be very clear, but if they're against the right-wing, very drastic attempts by the Netanyahu government against Palestine, it's very good that they are opposing it and in the streets to demonstrate against this genocidal policy. I'd like to make one comment. You mentioned some people who have been carrying it out these last actions in the last 2 days are not affiliated apparently with any other group. Well, I see this as a positive thing because the organization of the armed resistance is no longer completely controlled, even though it is a good thing, by the formal resistance, that people are taking things in their own hands. Like 30 young people were killed in Palestine by Israel just in the month of January, and the month is not yet finished. So put yourself in the position of a young Palestinian. They have to fight back, and the only way is by armed resistance.
Thank you so much. Unfortunately, we're going to have to end it. We're fresh out of time. Arnold August there, author and journalist from Montreal. Thank you. And Fry Hughes, author and director of the Palestine Aid Belfast from Belfast. With that, we come to an end for this edition of The Spotlight. For Mika Batakwe and the team, it's goodbye.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
A'udhu billahi minash shaitanir rajim. Bismillahir rahmanir rahim. In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, brothers and sisters. I am Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. In this edition of the program, we'll try to have a look at the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode. Dear listeners, now let's listen to 151st and 2nd verses of chapter Shu'ara.
Bismillahir Rahmanir Rahim.
In the name of Allah, the entirely merciful, the especially merciful.
وَلَا تُطِيعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ.
And do not obey the order of the transgressors.
الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا يُصْلِحُونَ
Who cause corruption in the land and do not amend.
Dear listeners, in continuation of what their prophet, Prophet Saleh, was telling these people after that he criticized them, he says, وَلَا تُطِعُوا أَمْرَ الْمُسْرِفِينَ Do not obey the bidding of the extravagant. And he goes on, الَّذِينَ يُفْسِدُونَ فِي الْأَرْضِ وَلَا يُصْلِحُونَ Those who make mischief in the earth and amend not. The point that we understood from these two verses is that the one who is extravagant is not qualified to be a leader. You should not follow him. And it is our responsibility as your prophets to warn you about the importance and the destruction of extravagance. Another point, you cannot expect your society and your nation to be improving, to be correcting. You cannot expect correction and rectification of your problems from these upper-class extravagant people. They try to justify their own actions by saying that we are amending, we are reforming. إِذَا قِيلَ لَهُمْ لَا تُفْسِدُوا فِي الْأَرْضِ قَالُوا إِنَّمَا نَحْنُ مُسْلِحُونَ They say we are only reformers, but the Holy Quran says, أَلَا إِنَّهُمْ هُمُ الْمُفْسِدُونَ These are exactly those who are causing mischief in the earth. So, according to what we said up to now, the relation between extravagance and corruption is made manifest. Because in a system that everything is in its place and everything is working correctly, any kind of exceeding the limits, exceeding the laws and limits, causes corruption and destruction. And so the origin of corruption is extravagance, and the cause and the consequence of extravagance is mischief. So this is the relation between extravagance and corruption. This is why the Holy Quran says and introduces musrifin as مفسدين الذين يفسدون في الأرض
نور على مر الزمان تألقا وأضاء للدنيا طريقا
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
In this
word.
Series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic
approach. We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
وتمثل القرآن في أخلاقه وفعاله فيه الفؤاد تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
According to the statement of Allama Tabatabai in Al-Mizan, the world of existence is holy order because it is righteousness, it is benefit, and nothing else. Even with the contrast which may sometimes be seen in its parts, it contains so much agreement. This system is moving towards some righteous aims, and this system arranges a particular path for each of its parts. Now, If one of these parts were to deviate from its orbit and paves the path of corruption, there will arise a conflict between this part and the other parts of this world which are moving in their own paths and directions. If this extravagant part can be returned to its main orbit, the better. Otherwise, they will destroy it so that the system can continue its own way, can move forward to its own perfection. If he goes forth according to his nature and be harmonious with the system of creation, he will attain the prosperous aim that has been determined for him. But if he exceeds the limits, if he steps in the path of corruption and mischief in the earth, the human being, at first Allah warns him by punishing him with grievous and painful retributions. So, the man is a part of this world of existence, and he is not an exception from this general law. The Almighty Allah tries to warn him by punishing him with grievous and painful events, as it is seen in chapter Rum, where it says, ظهر الفساد في البر والبحر بما كسبت أيدي الناس. Corruption has appeared in the land and the sea on account of what the hands of men have wrought. We will continue discussing this issue and elaborate on that later on in the next episode. Thank you for staying with us. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also visit our website at parsetoday.ir. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc., you wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Of Jalali, Tehran.
Rubashavit, Gaza.
Jerome Hughes, Brussels.
Saeed Poreza, London.
Rashan Saglam, Istanbul.
Sayed Amin Olemi, Kabul.
Shahana Bhatt, Indian administered Kashmir.
Round the world with reporters.
Yemenis are urging their government to take decisive action to end the Saudi-led blockade on Yemen before the month of Ramadan begins. Due to Saudi Arabia's strangling blockade, food, fuel, and gas prices increased drastically during the holy month. Here at the Al Sanaa market, where many Yemenis do their shopping, customers said they want their government to adopt measures that will resuscitate Yemen's economy and end the continuous price hikes.
The strangling blockade is why food prices are increasing. When prices increase, it makes life harder for business owners.
We ask our government to improve our ballistic missile capability because it is our missile capability that will break the siege.
According to Mohammed Miftah, who is an advisor to the president of Yemen's Salvation Government, the cabinet's main task is to keep Yemen's battered economy afloat in the midst of a brutal war.
The government's main task, given the current circumstances, is to provide essential services like electricity, water, and building roads so people can travel. It's true, prices remain high. However, in the near future, the government aims to provide services at a lower price. In general, the main cause of the surge in prices is the Saudi blockade.
Mohammed Miftah says, despite the surge in prices, the Saudi-led coalition's war on Yemen's economy is leading to nowhere.
The enemy was hoping to strangle Yemen's economy completely by preventing all fuel and gas from entering Yemen. We have successfully foiled this plan, and now fuel and gas are available, even though they're slightly overpriced. The important thing is that they're available, which is more important.
For the time being, the Yemeni government shows a willingness to engage in peaceful political dialogue to end the war. However, much of the public has lost hope in the peace process.
Yemeni people are calling on the Salvation Government to break Saudi Arabia's siege on the country before the holy month of Ramadan. Sana'a has called on Riyadh to lift the blockade multiple times. The kingdom has so far refused the requests, which means Yemen's next option could be a military one. Yusuf Maudi, Sana'a.
The memory of the rape and murder of pedestrian Sarah Everard in 2020 by then Metropolitan Police Officer Wayne Cousins is seared on everybody's mind here. The police commissioner at the time, Cressida Dick, called it a case of a few bad apples in the force and promised action to weed them out. She was soon forced to resign, leaving a police force in crisis. The latest scandal to rock the Met, David Carrick, an officer from the same unit as Wayne Cousins, pleading guilty to tens of offenses, including rape against 12 women over nearly two decades. The response from the new commissioner, Mark Rowley, an apology and the promise of a cleanup. Yet critics of the Metropolitan Police Force say they don't think that will solve the problem.
I think the proposition that it's just a few bad apples has been blown completely out the water. What we have in reality is a deeply systemized culture of misogyny and racism that speaks and exists at the very heart, the core of the Metropolitan Police Service. It is beyond reform. It is beyond saving.
The force Commissioner Rowley commands was placed under special measures last year after revelations of bullying, racial discrimination, and misogyny among some of its officers against people inside and outside the force. New anonymous revelations from serving police officers speak of a culture of racism and sexual abuse in the force, which has left some black staff suicidal.
The issue is that systematized culture actually targets and alienates black and ethnic minority officers. And that has a profound impact upon their family life, their mental health, their physical health. And we've seen examples, haven't we, time and time again, of black officers suffering life-changing, transforming trauma as a consequence of facing racism in the Met.
These are dark days for Britain's largest police force, with confidence in policing already at an all-time low. And the recent admission by one of its own will worsen trust in the people who are supposed to be protecting society. Cyprus is up, London.
Latest surveys are indicating that more and more people in Italy are against continuing to send weapons to Kiev and are calling for a peaceful settlement of the conflict in Ukraine. According to a Euromedia poll, over half of Italians, about 52%, oppose supplying Ukraine with modern Western-made weapons, up several percentage points from mid-December. Furthermore, almost 7 out of 10 respondents were also against a possible intervention of NATO in the conflict.
Sending more weapons doesn't make any sense. More arms means more destruction and a never-ending war.
After weeks of doubts, Italy has confirmed it is ready to supply Ukraine with its highly costly SAMP/T air defense system. Italy only has 5 SAMP/T batteries, which has led to concerns over the weakening of the country's defense capability. Also, other polls show a growing opposition among Italians to an even more active role by the Giorgia Meloni government in the conflict. According to a survey commissioned by the state broadcaster RAI, an overwhelming majority of Italians, almost 80%, believe that the Ukraine conflict is far away from them. Another survey carried out by market research company SWG has revealed over half of Italian citizens oppose the government's plans to raise defense spending to 2% of GDP by 2028. Doing so would align the country with NATO's desired threshold.
I think that increasing our spending on weapons now is insane. We are already strangled by high inflation, high cost of living. I'm against the government's plan.
Italy counts very little at an international level. I am afraid it would be much more useful to remain inside the current international context and go with the flow.
Italy's next aid and military package to Ukraine is to be announced by the Meloni government in the early days of February. Max Civili, Rome.
Like other parts of the Muslim world, tempers are running high in Pakistan over the repeated Islamophobic incidents by some European countries in recent days. Outraged Pakistanis took to the streets of the capital Islamabad after Friday prayers to condemn the West for what they call its malicious anti-Islamic agenda.
Burning of Muslims' holy book by these Western nations proved that Islamophobic acts were not an expression of freedom of speech, but extremism. Sadly, extremism exists and is growing everywhere in Europe. It's time for European nations to think about who's promoting extremism by desecrating other religions.
Protesters chanted slogans and vented their anger against the silence of the West regarding repeated incidents of desecration of Holy Quran and the Prophet Muhammad. Demonstrators also called on Muslim nations to boycott European goods over what they describe as the West's insolent behavior.
We strongly condemn the blasphemous incident of desecration of the Holy Quran in Sweden. The incident is the worst and most heartbreaking act in Europe. There is no room for such a sad incident in a civilized society.
Demonstrators are demanding that the Organization of Islamic Cooperation, known as OIC, raise its voice against the growing intolerance against Islam and anti-Muslim acts across the globe.
It's time for the OIC to play its role in urging Muslim nations to stand united against Western conspiracies. Europe wants to ignite Muslims by doing such blasphemous acts. Once we are united, Europe will not dare to repeat such Islamophobic acts.
The countrywide rallies came days after Pakistan denounced what it described as the abhorrent act of desecration of the Quran in Sweden and the Netherlands, saying such acts disrespect Muslims across the globe.
Condemnations continue to pour in from Muslim countries across the world. Yemen, Qatar, along with other Islamic nations, joined Iran, Pakistan, and Turkey to denounce the desecration. Nasser Kazmi, Islamabad.
People of Afghanistan are extremely upset about the deplorable and shocking act of some extremist individuals in Sweden and Holland in desecrating the Holy Quran, which is taken as a disrespect towards not just the Holy Book of Muslims, but all holy scriptures, by tearing the Holy Quran and setting it on fire. The primitive and uncivilized act of a bunch of radical elements in Europe has raised robust condemnation from Afghan people against such abominable act.
They claim human rights and still burn the Holy Quran. It looks like it's only for themselves. We want the Swedish government to punish the perpetrator of this action, and also ask Islamic countries to be united against this action.
Even when such people insult the Holy Quran, the book's value increases for us. If we are not burning their holy books in response today, it is because of the teaching of the Holy Quran to have a peaceful relation with all people.
The Minister of Foreign Affairs of the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan has also condemned the awful action and called for punishment of its perpetrators in Sweden and Holland.
We ask the government of Sweden to punish the perpetrators of this crime and do not let such individuals to act in provocative and heinous ways against the holy books.
The Holy Quran is simply a fundamental element to unite Muslims, so that Afghan politicians from various groups and ethnicities, including former administrators and current statesmen at the Islamic Emirate of Afghanistan, break ranks with the disgusting radical act towards the Holy Book committed by some extremist groups in Europe, and roundly condemn the disgusting act under the guise of freedom of speech. The Afghan politicians unanimously announced that the spirit and essence of coexistence of ideas and thoughts is definitely on the line, then on.
During the protest, people of Afghanistan have called for the unity among believers of all Ibrahimic religions towards such targeted attacks, which have mainly aimed at weakening believing souls and freedom seekers of the entire world, and not just Islam and Muslims. Abdullah Mirzadeh, Kabul.
Thousands of people have taken part in the funeral procession of Palestinians killed in the Israeli forces raid on the West Bank city of Jenin Thursday. Carrying the martyrs' bodies, the mourners chanted slogans condemning the Israeli crimes. It was early Thursday when Palestinian media reported the regime forces raid on the Jenin refugee camp. The savage attack left the residents and popular resistance groups based in the camp with no choice but to defend themselves and confront the regime forces.
What happened today in Jenin Governorate is a massacre in the very sense of the word. We received 8 martyrs and 1 martyr in Ibn Sina Hospital. In addition to 18 wounded, 3 of them are in a very serious condition. Most of the injuries were due to direct targeting with the aim of killing.
Later in the day, the Israeli troops fatally shot another Palestinian in the town of Al-Ram, near the occupied city of Al-Quds. The Palestinian was killed during a protest against the Israeli forces' raid on Jenin. With a total death toll of 10, January 26th turned into one of the deadliest days in the occupied West Bank since Israel's military raids intensified at the start of last year. Iran's foreign ministry reacted to the bloody incident. It called on Muslim countries to unite and coordinate their actions in support of the oppressed Palestinian nation and the resistance to stop the apartheid regime's acts of terror. Palestinian resistance groups have also condemned the Israeli atrocity in the strongest words, calling for continued resistance against the regime.
The massacre that the Israeli occupation army committed in Jenin confirms the racist, fascist, and criminal nature of the right-wing occupation government. This aggression, in addition to the continued violations at the Al-Aqsa Mosque and of the rights of the Palestinians in Israel, shows that this government insists on escalating the situation.
Our resistance will carry on and shall not back off from confronting this Zionist occupier, and the killing will not intimidate us and will not be intimidated by these threats made by the criminal leaders of this Zionist entity.
Palestinian resistance movements say the latest Israeli raid on Jenin comes within the context of recent escalations, especially in light of the new far-right cabinet headed by Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu and his extremist allies. Hamas and Islamic Jihad have both expressed readiness to fight back in case these raids continue. Analysts believe that Palestinians need to bolster resistance against Israel to neutralize the regime's vicious plots.
The resistance should continue and should be escalated against the Israeli, and they should know that they should pay the price for all crimes they are committing.
Actually, they mean to eliminate the resistance in the West Bank, in the occupied West Bank, to pave the way to construct more Israeli settlements in the West Bank, in which we all know that these settlements are internationally illegal.
Jenin is among those areas in the northern West Bank where Israel intensified its raids over the past year in an attempt to crack down on the Palestinian resistance. In addition to Palestinian resistance fighters, civilians confronting the Israeli army during such raids and even bystanders have been killed mercilessly. More than 170 Palestinians, including at least 30 children, were killed across the occupied West Bank last year. Moreover, at least 29 Palestinians, including 5 children, have been killed in January 2023 alone.
I'm heading with humanitarian aid workers to drop off desperately needed supplies to civilians on the outskirts of Donetsk. Recently, fighting has become fierce as Russia seeks to advance across much of Donbass. A Russian tank fires at Ukrainian positions. As we drive, the boom of incoming not far off, we see the smoke rising from amongst the trees. A few moments later, a Russian artillery unit emerges from the site of the strike. They were hit. We arrive at the arranged gathering site to drop off the supplies. These people live only hundreds of meters from the front and spend most of their time cowering in their apartments.
Now, while I have reported on dozens of the Ukrainian terror strikes in the center of Donetsk, where there are no discernible military targets, bus stations, schools, markets, here we're so close to the front line that the civilians who live here run the extreme risk of getting hit by indirect Ukrainian fire. You can hear the constant incoming and outgoing around these areas. The people here tell me that just yesterday a music school was hit, killing a local man.
Tatiana Montion is a renowned Ukrainian lawyer, today helping to deliver aid.
Where they have to live. You can imagine how many people here. It's about 100,000 people all around the front line. How is it possible to move these people somewhere in safe place? It's impossible, absolutely impossible. So we do what we do. They have no shops, they have no transport, they have no possibility to feed themselves, so we help them.
Tatiana fled Kiev to Donbass 2 years ago, fearing arrest for her outspoken criticism of the Ukrainian government.
Everybody here understands that it's United States made all this trash to weaken European economy, to crash European economy, to force European industry to move to United States. Everybody here understands it. But why not European people? Ordinary people, of course, because I am sure that European top elite understands it best of all. But they're too corrupt to tell about it to their peoples.
On our way to the next drop-off, we're stopped by Russian soldiers. They tell us not to carry on the same road. We get out of the car to assess our options. There is heavy fire nearby. That's the reality across much of Donbass. Back in the car, massive incoming close by, and we're left no choice but to drive fast. In this desolate post-apocalyptic wasteland, it's artillery doing most of the killing. At the next drop-off, this woman tells me her mother is dying on the other side of the front, so she can't be with her in her final days. She breaks down in tears, saying she wants both sides to negotiate a peace. With peace negotiations further away than ever, both Russia and NATO seem determined to end this war with brute force. For the civilians trapped along either side of the battle lines, survival is a daily chore. Many won't see the end of the war. Many won't see the end of this week. Johnny Miller, Donetsk.
Celebrating January 26th, best known as Australia Day, has become increasingly controversial in recent years, with people holding rallies on this day to highlight the historical plight of Aboriginals. Many Indigenous Australians who traced their lineage on the continent back 50,000 years regard it as Invasion Day. Tens of thousands of protesters lined up in Sydney, while thousands more gathered in Melbourne, Canberra and other cities, saying the day marks the beginning of colonial oppression and genocide.
Nobody's got the right to celebrate genocide. That's it. This is ground zero, genocide. Ground zero happened here on 26th of January, 1788. Nobody should be celebrating. It's not an event to celebrate.
The government has designated January 26th as National Day, which marks the anniversary of the 1788 arrival of the first fleet of British ships in Port Jackson. But protesters believe the government is still trying to gloss over the scale of British colonizers' crimes against Native Australians.
I think most white Australians would not celebrate this day at all if they knew exactly that level of depression and deep sadness.
There are several accounts of how colonizers wiped out Indigenous communities in Australia through brutal and heart-wrenching repression. Emily Caroline Cray, a young settler traveling through northwest Queensland in 1883, recounts some of the British colonizers' horrendous crimes in her personal diary.
The station owner has 40 pairs of blacks' ears nailed around the walls collected during raiding parties after the loss of many cattle speared by the blacks.
Aboriginal people remain the most disadvantaged Australians, with higher rates of poverty, health issues and imprisonment than any other community. Now more than 2.5 centuries later, they're still struggling to find their feet in a white-dominated society. Australia's Prime Minister is planning to hold a referendum in March on recognizing around 4% Indigenous people in the Constitution. But repeated calls to abolish the controversial National Day have failed on deaf ear, as the government remains adamant to celebrate what many call the anniversary of Australia's colonization.
Iran's domestic production capacities. In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. As you know, the leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, adopts every Iranian calendar year with a theme which fits to the conditions of the time. The leader named this year as the year of production, knowledge base, job creating. The themes of the year are chosen by Ayatollah Khamenei to motivate the officials and the people towards putting the internal potential capacities into effect to push the country on the course of progress. Thus, we have prepared a series to briefly review Iran's capacities in various fields. In the sixth episode of this series, you will get familiar with Iran's progresses in the medical and hygiene field. Stay tuned, please. Medical equipment industry has developed with the growth of human communities. The value of medical equipment market is more than $500 billion, and it is estimated that this section will continue growing due to the increase of senile population and spread of some diseases. Presently, the U.S. enjoys 39% of the share of this market, and Germany, Japan, and China stand in the next positions. The Islamic Republic of Iran has greatly invested in the medical equipment section. The rate of medical equipment growth is 9.1% in Iran, which is higher than the global average. Iran's medical equipment market enjoys a capacity of $7 billion. $2 billion of this figure is secured via imports, and $5 billion is produced by domestic companies. The Islamic Republic exported $24 million of medical equipment in 2017 to some 55 countries. The government has increased the budget of hygiene section every year. Moreover, health tourism is also on the rise in Iran, and many people come to Iran for treatment of various diseases. The Islamic Republic has the fifth greatest medical equipment market in the region.